Come on, we're waist deep in the big muddy. The big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy. The big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy. The big fool says to push on. Waist deep, neck deep. Soon even a tall man will be over his head. We're waist deep in the big muddy. The big fool says to push on. Give me that old-time religion, give me that old-time religion, give me that old-time religion, it's good enough for me. Let us pray with Aphrodite, let us pray with Aphrodite, she wears that see-through nighty, and it's good enough for me. Oh, give me that old-time religion, give me that old-time religion, give me that old-time religion, it's good enough for me. We'll pray with Zarathustra, we'll pray just like we used to. I'm a Zarathustra booster, and it's good enough for me. Oh, give me that old-time religion, give me that old-time religion, give me that old-time religion, it's good enough for me. We will pray with those Egyptians, build pyramids to put our crypts in, cover subways with inscriptions, and it's good enough for me. Oh, give me that old-time religion. Pray with those old druids, they drink fermented fluids, waltzing naked through the woods, and it's good enough for me. Oh, give me that old-time religion, give me that old-time religion, give me that old-time religion, it's good enough for me. Hare Krishna, he must laugh on to see me dressed in saffron with my hair that's only half on, and it's good enough for me. Oh, give me that old-time religion, I will rise at early morning when my Lord gives me the warning that the solar age is dawning, and that's good enough for me. Oh, give me that old-time religion, give me that old-time religion, give me that old-time religion, it's good enough for me.
This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and yes, the imagination. I am Jim Freund. With us this morning, postponed from last week, but yeah, we're doing it, Nancy Hightower. If you don't know, you'll find out. If you do know, stay tuned. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Woof. Woof. If there's one thing that can be said for I, Frankenstein, the new film in which Aaron Eckhart plays the Frankenstein monster, who here eventually takes the name of his creator as his own, and is also given the first name of Adam Frankenstein, don't think about that too long. The one thing that can be said about the movie is that the finale is about the most messed up goddamn thing you're ever going to see. There are martial arts battles and flying gargoyles fighting demons and this big iron steampunk machine spitting lightning and a million corpses hung on rotating racks that are like the things they've got in dry cleaners but big and the souls of the damned flying up from hell like fireballs and infesting the revivified corpses. Pretty much all CG, makes good use of the 3D process, there's a real sense of depth to everything, and it's just nuts. Almost makes the price of admission worthwhile. Almost. I have no real problems with taking the Frankenstein monster and suggesting he's lived for centuries and then bringing him to a present-day European city. I'm not sure they ever specify where, not sure they care. And having the monster fight demons and come into conflict with gargoyles who are also fighting demons, but don't have much patience for an ageless demon puncher who plays by his own rules. That's no big deal. Once you accept that Frankenstein has met the Wolfman and Dracula and Abbott and Costello, everything's on the table as far as I'm concerned. But not this way, which is just sort of ham-fisted and silly and attempts to rise to epic status ideas that can't really support that kind of stature. There are some concepts where the less explanation you get, the better. When you've got the Frankenstein monster and gargoyles and demons and they're all fighting each other, really the best thing to do is to just drop us in the middle of that and say, here it is, deal with it. Odds are good that we will. The attempt here to have the monster hanging out with the gargoyles in an expository sequence that clues us into the mythology just had me giggling by the end. Not the best way to start out your eye-candy-stuffed action film. I, Frankenstein is directed by Stuart Beattie, who previously wrote the quite good Michael Mann, Tom Cruise film Collateral, and also directed a small, pretty decent science fiction survival film Tomorrow, When the War Began. He loses it here. He muddles Adam Frankenstein's motivation. Does he want to find his origins or understand his creator or finally get the bride that Dr. Frankenstein promised him centuries ago or live or die? And the film becomes a hacky scenario in which the leader of the demons, played by Bill Nye, who generally manages to bring it to whatever role he's in, but here looks like he has no idea what to do with this stuff. The leader of those demons needs the monster to raise his infernal army. How isn't particularly clear. What I, Frankenstein, boils down to is essentially a 90-minute special effects demo reel, which kind of becomes a drag after a while, no matter how good-looking it is or how nicely deployed the 3D is. And it is pretty good, let me say that. The film substitutes shallow flash for just acknowledging how goofy its central concept is and then just running with it. I'm Dan Persons. If you love science fiction, fantasy, and horror film, please check out Cinefantastique online over at cfqonline.com.
Thank you, Dan. I didn't hear the review. I didn't have a chance. But if it wasn't a pan, it had to be a pan. I, Frankenstein, really... I mean, you know, there was an I, Frankenstein, and it was written by none other than Christopher Isherwood. The Isherwood, as in, you know, the Berlin stories. I Am a Camera, the same author of that. We have a professor of literature in this room, and, well, now Christopher Isherwood, I think, is... No, Charles Isherwood is the guy from the New York Times, so I was right. Christopher Isherwood wrote a teleplay that starred Michael Sarrazin as the monster. And it was actually, you know, not that far removed from Mary Shelley. It was one of the first productions I had ever seen, media productions, that had any idea that there was this woman who wrote this book that basically started modern science fiction. It's Frankenstein. I say, as Brian Aldiss does, that it's the first... science fiction novel. The first modern science fiction novel. Anyway, I was going to play some Seeker. How could I not play Seeker? But Robert Knight on Earthwatch has just done a wonderful job in playing some of the essential Seeker songs. And I was only going to play one. And I thought... I would be a little bit more upbeat, you know, if I have a hammer, everybody sing along, you know, that kind of positive energy thing rather than the maudlin of turn, 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 or where have all the flowers gone, something really sad. Next week, whole show, I started my favorite music when everybody else my age was listening to the Beatles, I was listening to the Weavers. I was listening to Seeger. I was listening to Woody Guthrie. I was listening to Judy Collins, Phil Oakes. People say online, talking about the movie Inside Llewyn Davis, which I have not yet seen. How could you know about the Greenwich music scene in 1961? Well, my uncle took me. Yes, I was 8 years old. No, I did not really totally assimilate. By 1967, I was in that scene. I was there. I was at the Gaslight, Gertie's Folk City, and the WBAI Free Music Store at Washington Square Methodist Church, for which I ran the door for 15 years, and got paid $5 a concert for that. Big money at WBAI. And wonderful performers like Christine Lavin, who I believe I gave her radio debut. And I should call Chris and see if she's available. She's been doing, get this, laptop concerts. Okay, check out her Facebook page. There is a website that basically just allows you to stream for an hour or 2 hours or whatever, and you perform. And there's a tip jar. And great folk singers and performers and comedians and stuff like that just have their laptops and their mic camera and maybe an accompanist or not, and perform using their laptop, performing into their computer, onto there, and you pay them money. And the website, the hosting website, gets a percentage of the money. So these are laptop concerts. And Chris Lavin, who is, of course, one of my favorite folk singers. Although she's not a folk singer. She's a singer-songwriter. Okay, next week. Next week, Jim. Okay, Jim? Next week. Just slapped me. Deservedly so. Because we have a guest. Nancy Hightower is with us. And I'm going to actually, I am ill-prepared. I am going to ask you, and you know, I really ought to have your bio with me. Damn it, I don't. Because I need to be promoting next Tuesday's reading where you're appearing. So say hi.
Hello, everybody.
Yeah, you don't have to lean toward the mic.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We control the vertical and the horizontal over here.
Right over here.
Yeah, yeah, very good. Sounds fine. Except these headphones don't work, but outside of that, it sounds fine.
Okay.
So, Nancy Hightower has her first novel out, her debut novel. I have not been, by the way, able to talk to anybody with and dropping Nancy's name without their going, oh, I love her stuff. I love her work. Or love her because I was speaking to an artist 2 days ago, John Picascio.
John, he's like my big brother.
Yeah, well, and I said, well, I'm, you know, I've got a reading next week with Daniel Friedman, and he's providing an illustration for the gallery where we're going to be doing the reading. And I said, you should hear my show sometime, John. I would love to have you on the radio so you can talk about art. And it's like, okay, cool. He, you know, comes to New York from Texas occasionally. And I said, well, yeah, you ought to listen tomorrow night. I'm going to have Nancy Hightower on. He was like, oh, God.
Aw.
He was great.
He's wonderful.
Yeah, he really is. He really is. But the point is that he said Nancy Hightower is wonderful. Oh, so you are a professor.
Yes.
Dr. Hightower, therefore.
Yes.
Because I want to promote next week's reading as the two doctors.
Yes.
Because a medical doctor and technically, what doctor of what exactly are you? It's a PhD.
It's a PhD, yes. So doctor of philosophy, of course.
Yeah.
Although I think me and Danielle could probably own a TARDIS and go sailing into the universe. And
yeah, I think so.
Do
yeah.
readings across.
Can I be your companion?
Yes,
you
of course.
Yeah.
You can.
Okay.
We'd love to have you come fly with us.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Schedule all kinds of readings on different planets.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
We could totally do that.
Oh, absolutely. We can have multiple readings simultaneously by using the TARDIS.
Ooh, I like that idea.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I want to be everywhere.
Yeah, and we're never going to run out of room for audience.
No.
In December, we ran out of room for the live audiobook that we did of Ellen Kushner's right. Swords Point books. And for the first time that we were at the gallery, we turned away, we don't know how many people, we think about 40.
Oh, wow.
We crammed in, I won't say, because the fire marshals wouldn't care to hear okay. the number of people who made it into the room.
It'll be our special secret then.
Yeah, yeah. So I shouldn't say on the radio that we had like 75, 80 people.
Ooh, wow.
Yeah, it was something. That was more people than when we had Jonathan Lethem. I mean...
That was like sitting in laps.
Yep, and it was the second largest reading we've had. The largest was Susanna Clarke.
Oh.
The week that Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell came out, the week that book came out, she was on my show, and I was so proud. I was so happy to have that happen. And by the way, coming to your TV set later this year, as a BBC miniseries, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell will be on BBC America. We shall see if it's any good.
Dun, dun, dun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm always suspicious. I'm always suspicious. I'm already suspicious of Peter Capaldi, you know.
Yes.
Tell me more about Nancy Hightower.
Well,
because I will just talk. Okay, and I'll just sit and listen
and be mesmerized because I'm in a radio station, which I've never been. I've taught college for 18 years, mostly at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And I've just recently moved to New York City in July, actually, to write.
Although I met you December before last.
You did.
You came to a Nirsif reading and Kushner, Ellen Kushner, that is, introduced us.
Yes, she did. Well, because I made 6 trips to New York before I decided I want to live here, because it just seemed sort of silly to quit my job, sell my house, and just plop over here.
Yeah,
without doing some sort of, you know,
prep work,
field reconnaissance, and decided that this was where the art scene was, because I also am an art critic. I write essays for Weird Fiction Review, which is Anne and Jeff Vandermeer's blog. And it's the editor is
Jeff
Adams.
Is coming to New York end of February.
Yes,
by
he
the
is.
Way.
Yes, he has 2 readings, which is going to be really exciting.
I know of one at Word. Where's the other one?
I want to say Rand McNally.
Hmm.
But one's on the 26th, and I think one's
McNally Jackson.
There we go. I knew McNally was in there somewhere.
You see, now, I'm very surprised at that, because they got very snotty about having science fiction people. They used to do all kinds of stuff with Ellen Datlow and folk like that, and then they just, like, you know, shooed everybody out.
But now they're welcoming us back in.
No, they're welcoming. They like Vandermeer.
Well, that's okay. We all love him.
He's highbrow.
He's a doll. He's one of those people that welcomed me into
He's
the...
not doing my show in February. That's all I know.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He's doing it in May.
Oh, well, okay. So he's coming.
Yeah. He did it last May. He does my show whenever he's here for the book expo.
Oh, so that's perfect. May, spring. Yeah. And when you think of Jeff Vandermeer, don't you think of spring and bunnies and running through the fields and flowers? I'm hoping Jeff is listening to this right now.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And if he isn't, he should be. I'll send him an email.
Or I definitely want a picture of him running through the fields with bunnies and flowers.
I think there are a lot of people that would pay good money
to see that. Be awesome.
Yeah, we'll do a Kickstarter for that.
Yeah, and not doing bad things to the bunnies.
Oh, no. Yeah. Dancing.
Dancing with the bunnies.
All of them.
Oh, yes. No, I want
at
a YouTube video of that right now.
Yeah.
So.
Can do. You can mash anything nowadays with technology.
Yes, it's beautiful.
Okay, so I'm sorry. I just sidelined you.
I love talking about anybody except for myself. So the only other thing is I recently got a gig writing book reviews for the Washington Post. So
yeah,
that little gig, which is it's great because I get a chance to introduce some fabulous pieces of fiction every month.
So. And Washington Post actually has a great history of covering science fiction, which most newspapers do not. The New York Times for years had a critic who almost openly hated, a science fiction critic who hated science fiction. You know, it's like, why?
Yeah, so this, I mean, I'm excited about this. So
yeah, this is great.
New York is a great place of opportunity where you can try different hats on. You can be sort of anything that you want here.
Yeah.
And I got to take a year off of teaching and just write, so that's pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And explore the culinary arts of New York City,
yes.
And I'm in the East Village, so it's just been
You're in the heart of culinary.
Exceptionally fun.
Yes, absolutely. Do you go down to Chinatown?
I've only been once.
Oh, we have to fix that.
And so, well, because my area of town is just amazing.
To get you to Wohops.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, this is a place where $5 will buy you an amazing meal.
I think it's called Shanghai Palace, and had the soup dumplings.
Yeah, those are lovely.
Those are really lovely. But, you know, I have my favorite little places.
But they said that's not even in Chinatown. That's on 8th Street. St. Mark's place.
No. This place was actually in Chinatown. So maybe Shanghai Palace wasn't the right one. But this was in Chinatown.
Oh, maybe it was. I love soup dumplings.
Yeah,
oh,
no.
My God. They explode in your mouth and that soup just got gushing out. Yeah.
It was tasty.
I've made regular dumplings. I've not yet found the secret to cooking soup dumplings.
I don't cook.
I do.
very good. I wish I could cook. I'm not going to learn here. That's for certain, because I just like to eat out, like, all the time. It's, like, the best thing.
Yeah.
I moved here just to try everything.
But you're right near all the great Indian restaurants.
Yes, Milan. Have you ever...
Yes.
Oh, yeah. The lights.
Yeah, but the best one is gone. The best one was the Shabak on 6th Street. It was the first on the block, as they called it. And they were on 6th Street, just off of 2nd Avenue. Joanna Russ lived on the first floor above it. And a science fiction fan, John Singer, lived on the third floor. And, you know, just go down there and say, okay, I've ordered the biryani. Everybody come down and read.
Yeah, yum. I love it.
Yeah, it was great.
It's so much fun. So, yeah.
That was the East Village of the early 70s.
Oh, yes.
Ellison lived about 5 blocks from there, and Robert Silverberg. This was before they all went West Coast. We're all in that neighborhood, so.
Very nice.
Great neighborhood.
Yeah.
And we had BAI people down there, too. Marshall Efron. I won't divulge his or your location. Same block.
Thank you. Okay. Well, I'm glad you didn't divulge my location.
Yes, I know.
Everybody.
But Marshall Efron, most people today won't know who he is. Go to YouTube, EFRON. Watch his old videos from a great TV show called The Great American Dream Machine.
Okay.
They're about 5 minutes long each.
I will do it.
Oh, yeah.
I promise.
Do it.
Okay.
And a lot of them are about food.
Yay.
Like, how do they name the sizes of olives? Jumbo. It's, anyway.
Okay.
What is it you teach?
This is sort of interesting. So I teach different things in the program for writing and rhetoric, or I did for a number of years. One of the classes was the grotesque in art and literature. Yeah, I know. And I always get that look that you're flashing me right now of, like, what is the grotesque?
Oh, I know some pretty grotesque people.
Well, people use it, like, pejorative to mean bizarre, but I sort of had more a stricter boundary around it. So it was, like, humor and horror.
Well, okay, exactly. Because, absolutely, because there is an art, I happen to know, because I just saw a couple of grotesques yesterday. I was visiting, actually, a soup kitchen, which used to be an actor's house. Mm-hmm. This is a place you will probably see because I'm going to produce some events there. And they had a hearth with grotesques on either side. Little friezes of imps, mm-hmm, thumbing their nose and being rude. And unless I am mistaken, these are called grotesques.
Yeah, the grotesque. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Thank grotesque. You.
Yeah, those are like the oldest forms of the grotesque.
Yeah.
So I traced it into like what the newer forms of the grotesque look like.
This would be like very early 20th century.
Oh, okay.
You know, so it's not like, you know, the European.
The ancient, right, okay.
The real things that I think were usually on pews to amuse people.
Those were a form of them, yes?
Yes. Yeah.
Part of that, and on the frescoes. And yeah, no, I taught.
So funny and evil, yeah.
Not evil.
I'm not evil. Horror, yeah.
And a deep. A deep-seated psychological horror. So I would teach things like Santa Sangre by Jodorowsky or Lars von Trier's Antichrist. And I would teach
which
it.
Which I have not seen and probably cannot.
I only teach it in conjunction with the Yellow Wallpaper. So I have my students read like the Yellow Wallpaper first by Charlotte Perkins Gilman. And then we watch Antichrist as an updated version of the Yellow Wallpaper.
Uh-huh.
Because it's about a man and a woman. The man's a doctor. He's telling the wife she's not going crazy.
Who was in that film?
Charlotte Gainsbourg and, oh, the villain in Spider-Man, in the first Spider-Man movie. Oh, I cannot believe I'm having to go here.
Yeah, yeah.
Who is the guy?
And I'm blanking as well.
I have completely drawn a blank. And right now, if my students are listening,
it's amazing how Lars von Trier gets these wonderful actors to do these. I think the word grotesque fits a lot of his films.
Yes, I that's the only one I'm really comfortable teaching. And it's the one I think it's really important for my students to watch. I think it's an important film.
His next film, Nymphomaniac, first of a trilogy.
Ooh. That I'm not so much interested in. And plus, I'm taking a year off, so I'm just
watching. It'll make the press. It'll make the...
Yes. Yes. But I mean, I got to teach really cool stories, like from Kafka and Flannery O'Connor.
Yes.
And so, and I got my students to do these amazing photography projects where they did their own photography about grotesque scenes, and then they wrote about them. So it was a really interesting and dynamic class. I had them do crazy presentations of all kinds. One did their presentation just in the dark, things like that. So
that is pretty amazing. That is pretty cool.
Yeah,
teaching the grotesque, as it were.
It was a lot of fun.
Professor of the grotesque.
Yes.
What was the actual title of the course?
The Grotesque.
That's it. Wow.
That was it.
How wonderful is that?
So it drew in people from the night. Imagine teaching the grotesque at 8 in the morning, though. I once accidentally got an 8 a.m. grotesque
Simple,
class.
Simple, I stay awake all night.
I mean, it was... And there was one day where I'm not a morning person because I normally stay up till, you know, these odd hours. And I remember I was so mad about being up at 8 a.m. that when they came into the classroom, I blasted Buckethead, which is sort of this electric guitar. And they were, you know, and this was to get them ready to watch, say, Jodorowsky at 8 in the morning or Antichrist at 8 in the morning. There's only so much that you're...
The Iron Mountain.
I mean, there's only so much you can stand at 8 in the morning before you've had a cup of coffee.
Do you know that Jodorowsky was the first director chosen to direct the movie Dune? Before then, they settled on the rather laid-back David Lynch.
And he wanted Orson Welles in on it and Pink Floyd. Now, I know this story. They couldn't do it because of funding. I wish
Frank Herbert on the show at that time.
Yeah, oh, wow. I so wish he could have made it.
Oh, God.
That would have just been the most...
I wish Lynch had made the movie that he wrote. 7-hour film.
Oh, that would have been...
I've seen the screenplay.
Wow.
Because I worked at a talent agency at the time as a clerk, and we would get, you know, breakdowns of the cast and all that, and we were actually sent a copy of the screenplay. And, you know, little did they know that I, the receptionist, you know, was assigned. Nerd going, I have a copy of the script of Dune, and it was supposed to be a 7-hour movie in two parts.
Wow, that's a long movie.
Yeah, well, yeah, but you know, we now live in Peter Jacksonville.
That's true. Yeah.
So you know, that's a short subject.
I know. I like films short and sweet. And...
I like them all.
Okay.
Oh, Jesus. Sorry, that's me.
Okay.
I have crickets in my bag.
Yes. You've like actual crickets?
No.
Okay.
No. I haven't done this on the air yet, and it was given to me as a gift so I could use it on the air, but I haven't. Well, you know, if I make a dumb joke, which I do all the time.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Oh my gosh, are you going to use that on me tonight?
No.
Oh, please don't.
No.
Oh.
No, for you?
God. Oh, thank you. That's going to make me feel so much better.
There we go.
Yeah, no, I'm feeling the love now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I won't play the fourth one.
Okay. Oh, thank you.
It's Boo.
Oh, okay.
There's applause, Boo, crickets, and rimshot.
All right. I was going to say, you know, I teach the grotesque. I can pretty much handle it.
For some reason, every time I like raise my legs, I hit my bag where I keep it. And I always get...
Right. Well, for a moment, I worried that you actually kept... crickets in your knapsack, so.
No, keeping crickets are good luck. That would not be.
Well, it's New York. I've come to accept what people do. There's
only
many
in Chinatown.
Kinds. Okay. Well.
Only in Chinatown would that be acceptable behavior.
To have crickets?
Yeah. And carry them, yeah. Captive. You know.
I used to catch lightning bugs as a child.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Back on when I lived on the East Coast.
And Octavia Butler always kept June bugs. And so she was, when she was a little girl, so she was called Junie.
Oh, that I did not know. I don't even know what a June bug is.
Neither do I.
Okay, all right, good. I thought maybe that was something that you...
Yeah. Oh my God, it's already 2 o'clock.
Oh, okay.
So let me say, by the way, that this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and over WBAI.org. And this is Hour of the Wolf, and my name is Jim Freund. And with me, speaking occasionally, is Nancy Hightower. Your first novel is out.
Yes.
Elementary with an I.
Yes.
Elementar I, you know, like elementary... my dear whoever.
I call it Elementary. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, that Rising.
Yep.
And do you want to tell us about the book, or you just want to do the prologue?
Yeah, I can do a little bit of a little synopsis for it. Basically, what happens is the elements are supposed to stay asleep and dreaming, and that's how they give the Earth its life, you know, Earth, water, fire, and air. They had a guardian race watching over them that protected them while they slept, and that guardian race has disappeared. And so the elements have started waking up and creating havoc, basically, as the elements do.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a man named Jonathan, and his job is to find out what happened to the guardian race and to try to, in some way, restore balance to the elements. It was inspired by living in Colorado and watching the drought sort of ravage the land.
Yeah.
You know, and interesting sort of scenes that I was driving through snow or wind definitely got played out in the novel, so.
Yes, last week, you know, were we to have tried to make it up here to Harlem, that would have made a trip through Boulder, Colorado seem like a cakewalk.
I would have been sobbing.
Yeah.
I would have been weepy.
Yeah.
I would have taken a Valium.
Yeah.
Something.
Yeah, I would have too, but I was trying. I would
yes,
have been driving, but yeah, you know, that would have. I mean, it was bad enough tonight, and I'm always worried about black ice. You know, that skidding across ice that you can't see on the road. Right. That happened to me once.
Well, in Colorado, there wasn't the black ice, but there was this one strip of highway between Denver and Colorado, or between Denver and Boulder, that I had to go. And the wind was whipping the snow, so it made these snow snakes that would go back and forth. And you'd become
There's a fantastic image.
Oh, yeah. One, it plays out in... I mean, there are snow snakes in my book because they're so mesmerizing. And when you're trying to drive and there's these snow snakes on the road, you're just... You can't even concentrate because they're moving so gracefully and beautifully, and the conditions are so drastic and nerve-wracking. So things like that, or the wind that was so violent. I remember watching, you know, the 6'2" undergrad being blown off course as he's like walking across campus, and, you know, things like that when you're at the mercy of the elements, when, you know, for all our technology, there's no way that we can stop wind. We can harness it, but we can't control it.
Yeah.
And I love that.
Yeah, and yeah, which is why you spent some time in Chicago, the Windy City.
Oh.
From Boulder to Chicago, and then now you're in New York, and now we've got these high winds. I mean,
yes, but I only visit Chicago to visit my good friend Valia, so.
Yeah, okay, but I've only visited Chicago twice, but I, you know, on Michigan Avenue, it was tough to not fall down when there was ice. It was really difficult. I really think that they should have ropes along the sidewalk that you can hold on to. They were not kidding. You're, you know, 4 blocks off Lake Michigan.
Well, and so to watch, you know, the polar vortex and all these strange temperatures, and it's just been, it's weird when you're writing about the elements and when you're caring, and when, global, you know, climate change influences what you're writing, and then to see it play out.
Right after the album Wintersmith came out.
Okay. That I don't know.
Oh, well, Steel Ice Ban, who is my favorite band.
Okay.
Who the outro music will be Steel Ice Ban, did an album with Terry Pratchett.
Oh.
Who the third Tiffany Aching novel, and if you haven't read the Tiffany Aching novels that are a subset of the Discworld books.
Okay.
Are just absolutely, utterly wonderful. It's the coming of age of a young witch. And the third book is about this young witch. I guess she's about 14 or 15 at the time, gets involved during the Dark Morris dance. And Winter thinks that she is the Summer Queen. And Winter, of course, can never see the summer and falls in love with her.
Okay.
And decides that he must have her. So Winter is now... So she is being chased by an element personified.
Oh, Right. Well, yeah, my elements all kind of do some battle with each other, depending on who they're loyal to.
And so this folk rock band that does mostly songs that are 200 years old, but electric.
Oh, okay.
It's a lot of what Steel Ice Band does. And anybody who listens to my show knows that I have a fetish for this band. And they're worth it. They're wonderful. They're just not as known in this country, although when they come to New York, they sell out. But they did their first theme album. They've been around for 43 years, about as long as this radio show. And their first themed album ever was a collaboration with Sir Terry Pratchett,
of all people.
And it's a fantasy album based on a fantasy novel. And I should get you a copy.
Yes. Yes, you should. I want one.
And it's called Wintersmith.
Lovely.
So see how it fits in?
Everything fits in. It's winter.
It's winter.
Who doesn't have something that goes with winter?
I have been not enjoying this particular polar vortex and all that. However, I must say, I prefer winter over summer.
How? Why?
Because summer in the city, it's hot. You can never peel off. You can always add layers in the winter. You cannot get rid of layers and not be arrested.
Okay.
In the summer, in order to stay cool.
Yeah, and I moved here in July, but I heard that it was a very mild summer.
Oh, this was, past, yeah, that was nothing.
So, yes. So
that
apparently,
was nothing. I mean, you know, New York can have 2 to 3 weeks at a time over 100 degree temperature.
Yes, I can't even imagine.
It's gotten, even though we have global warming, it's a slow process, but as a kid, I literally could, you know, I have seen people fry eggs on sidewalks. Not to mention cars. You can cook a steak on a car.
Right.
But
yes.
Yeah. It's summer can be brutal at times.
I'm looking forward to it. Yay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You know, and we have enough beaches in New York, and I go bird watching and things like that. But it's not that I love the winter. I like the temperate seasons. I like
spring, fall.
I like spring, fall.
Who doesn't?
I prefer the equinoxes over the solstice. So what's the plural for solstice?
Solstices? Solsti? I don't
solsti.
Know. Solsti. Well, it's 2 in the morning. At this
let's make it solsti. We're in a college. You're a professor. Come on.
Sure.
Okay. So now everybody, you know, go to Wikipedia. Enter this and it'll be official.
The solstice.
Solstice, yes, exactly. I'm sorry, Nancy. I'm having so much fun talking with you. But we are here to discuss your writing.
Oh, okay.
And also to promote your reading.
That's right.
So this coming Tuesday.
Yes.
Along with D.T. Friedman, Danielle Friedman, who was here, I guess, about 2 months ago and was just amazing. And you and she will be reading together, and I'm proud of that matchup.
Yes, we're
if
excited.
If I may say so, that pairing that I created there at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings this Tuesday. Doors open at 6:30 at 138 Sullivan Street at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art. It's this long, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art. You know, it's like, okay, yeah. Do that 3 times fast. And admission is free. We ask for donations so that we can buy our readers dinner.
Oh.
And we lost our dinner place.
Oh, right.
Milady.
We got a new one, though.
We got a new one.
Right.
Yeah, I was there 2 nights ago. They're very nice people, very nice people. And I won't promote them on the air quite yet. But
okay.
But all will work out.
All right. I think I promised on my Facebook page that there might be finger puppets for my reading.
Ooh.
And we're
going to be filming.
Oh, well, okay. Well, then I should start getting
absolutely.
Work
yeah,
on
yeah.
The finger
rehearse,
puppets.
Rehearse right. Them finger puppets.
All right. I jokingly talked about fire juggling, but
I've seen Christine Lavin. No, she didn't fire juggle. She did baton twirling.
I actually think Danielle has juggled fire at some point.
She says that in her bio.
Yes. So
she does say that.
Yeah, you know, these things are not outside the realm of possibility.
Okay, so the elemental stuff is really pervasive here.
Yeah, well, that we just to put on a good show.
Next Tuesday, Fire and Ice.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
There we go. Having nothing to do with George R.R. Martin, Fire and Ice.
You shall not be named. No. I love George Martin.
Who hasn't been on this show in about 25 years. So.
Oh.
There, he used to live in Hoboken.
Well, maybe if you promised him finger puppets.
We almost had a thing in October where I was going to interview him at Capclave, but I ended up not going to Capclave, where he was the guest of honor. Tiny little convention of 300 people, George Martin shows up. They must have had thousands.
Wow. That would be, he's a doll.
He's wonderful. He's
like
great.
Santa.
He's a very sweet guy.
He's adorable.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love him. Yeah.
Looks like a dwarf now.
He does not look like a dwarf.
He doesn't look like a dwarf?
No.
You don't think so?
No.
That beard and that little hat?
No. No. He just reminds me of Santa.
Even the New Yorker said.
No, well, yeah, the New York, yeah, that's what I'm known as.
And he's taller than I am, but I'm very short, so. But yeah, they did a great feature article on him. Elementary Rising. I understand it has a prologue.
It does have a prologue. Would you like me to read my prologue?
I would love for you to read your prologue. Do you mind if while you read your prologue I take pictures?
No, that's fine.
Oh, cool.
Just get my good side.
I will refrain from comment.
Okay. All right.
Being a gentle person.
Oh, well, bless you. I'm so glad that the crickets aren't going or the booing. So can I just start?
Absolutely.
All right. The Three Sisters Inn was full tonight, possibly crammed, too crammed with traders, guild officials, and sojourners from Irakal for him to escape the notice of prying eyes. The barber slipped the black hood over his head and drew the cloak tighter around his belly. It would not do if anyone caught sight of the three blue emblems emblazoned on his vest. Luckily, it was the hour when men had drunk enough of Molly's ale to dull certain senses and heighten others, but the girls were scarce tonight. Off in the corner, two men danced cheek to cheek, keeping time to the melancholy song being piped from one of the Irakins. He kept his head down as he wandered unsteadily between the long tables towards the staircase that led to the rooms. It wouldn't do to act sober or purposeful. "Damn these stairs," he muttered, as he began the slow climb up the narrow flight. He paused to catch his breath at the top before waddling down the dimly lit hall to the fourth room on the right. Three knocks, pause, two more. The door opened a crack and an eye peered out. "Who's there?" "I think my bulk alone would answer that question, Tarl," the man wheezed. "How many 300-pound barbers do you know?" Already the air felt stuffy, the room too small as he stepped across the threshold. The lamp cast scarcely enough light for the place. The barber had half a mind to keep the door open, but that's what fools did. Trust in light to save them, just as the cruel believed darkness covered all sin. Well, he was between the damned and the saved, so one lamp would do just fine. He closed the door behind him and stood there, dripping with sweat and wheezing like an old man. Tarl looked scarcely any better. The tanner was swaying side to side, his brown tunic and breeches still covered in soot. "How drunk are you?" the barber asked. Tarl looked down at his work-worn hands. "Drunk enough." The barber glanced at the little girl lying on the small hay bed in the corner of the room. "How long has she been like that?" "Just a little while," Tarl said. "She'll stay that way for the rest of the night." The barber nodded once. "Good enough. He'll be here soon. Then we can conduct our business and be on our way." "Is that what you're calling it now? Business?" "In light of the unfortunate circumstances that are about to plague us, yes." The barber unloosed the tie to his long cloak and flung it on the larger bed against the right wall. "I've made it my business to secure peace when war looms on the horizon. What else would you call it?" Tarl pointed to the three bloom emblems on the barber's vest. "I can think of a few other words." A sharp knock at the door. "Who's there?" Tarl barked. "Someone who will slit your throat if you don't let him in," a quiet voice replied. The barber heaved his body onto the center bed and motioned for Tarl to open the door. "It's him." Tarl opened the door wide enough for the tall gentleman to step inside. He wore the maroon cloak and gold badge of the Draper's Guild with knee-high leather boots. A rather good disguise, the barber thought. Too blonde, though. He liked his men a bit more dark and brooding. His women, too. Still, a handsome face with a strong jaw framed by short hair and a neatly trimmed goatee. The barber had to admire the cut and shape of both. The draper looked over to the corner bed. "Is she asleep?" Charles said. The draper nodded as he withdrew a small bag from his cloak. He opened it to reveal the gold coins that filled it to the brim. He picked one coin out and tossed it to Tarl. "Test it." Tarl threw it back at the draper's feet. "Ain't doing this for money, damn you." "What my friend here is trying to say is that there are more important things at stake," the barber quickly added, picking up the gold piece. He bit into it. Soft, just as it should be. He dropped it back into the draper's money bag. The draper drew the strings close. "You secure those stakes with this exchange, providing what you say about the girl is true." 4 long steps brought him to the small form asleep in the corner. She could not have seen more than 7 or 8 years. He knelt down beside her and brushed a lock of dark hair from her eyes. "Are you certain this is the one?" he asked softly, his face unreadable. "Oh, yes," the barber said. "Our sentries have watched her wandering the 7 woods alone for the last 6 months now. It took some time to catch her, for she seemed to know the forest better than the woodland guards." "I've heard legends about your woods," the barber said, still gazing at the little face. "Ours die so quickly." "Any forest will die if you lay an axe or a fire to it," the barber retorted, "which is why we are all here. Now let us get on with it." The draper stood up. "Why are you so nervous, Sir Barber?" he asked softly. "Do you know, perhaps, of others?" "I didn't know about this one until your visit a year ago," he said. "I found her. I know of no others, nor have I heard any tales of them. May Nialvar forgive us." He signed a triangle in the air, then folded his hands. Tarl did the same before quickly casting his eyes to the floor. "If your god had wanted them safe," the draper said, in a voice as smooth as the silk he wore, "he would have saved them in the first place. Don't you think?" "Such matters are beyond me," the barber sighed. "I am no priest, nor do I belong to the Order of the 7 Wood. I only wish to keep the passages between Galastad, Uruk-hul, and Lilithus clean of near Nemeron soldiers." "Don't worry, you'll have your peace." The draper hurled the bag of money straight at the fat man's chest, "and your pay." The barber flinched slightly as he caught the bag, let the brute think he was only doing it for the money and the security of the guilds. The draper went to kneel by the little girl. He placed his hand gently on her forehead. "Where will you take her?" "To the center of the 7 woods," Tarl slurred, "where we found her." The draper's ice-blue eyes shone. With understanding or desire, the barber couldn't tell. "An excellent choice," he said, gently kissing her brow before reaching for a second time into the depths of his cloak. Whatever their choices tonight, the barber thought, they were damned, all of them. "No, no, this is to keep damnation from coming," another voice inside him argued. The moonstone blade flickered purple in the candlelight, its jeweled hilt half hidden by the draper's hand. The barber turned his head away. The winter will invade before the Nemerons. This little human girl could do nothing to stop the violent winds and snow that would come with the Elementari's waking. But the real Terrakeen girl was out there, hiding, somewhere. He prayed this sacrifice would buy them time. Nyavallr, let someone find her before he does.
Nice. Very nice. Okay. So that's a great setup.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm. Are we still?
What?
Yeah. Okay.
Talk to me. Okay. But this is WBAI. We are as loose and free
loosey-goosey? Okay.
As people can be. Would you like me to play a cut of music?
A music?
A cut.
Take
a break. Why not?
Sure. I will take a swig of water.
Okay.
Because that prologue always kind of takes something from me.
You can do that, and I'll play, you know what? I'll play Wintersmith.
Oh.
How about that?
You got it already queued?
I've got it already queued. Mm. So there we are. And we'll be back in a few minutes.
Thank you. light. Keep us warm through the long winter night. Flames keep away the fearsome sight of the Winter Smith. The Winter Smith.
Pictures while Winter Smith is playing. But that was Steel I Span with a song from Terry Pratchett, who, if you listeners don't know, is a wonderful comic writer of great fantasy. Started out as satires, and then the Discworld books have become their own thing, and there are now three movies and all kinds of stuff, and a record album, and Sir Terry, I think, a second J.K. Rowling in contemporary sales in England. Wow. So he's done well for himself and for
an empire of fantasy.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. He when he comes to town, the publishers roll it out, but he has. He has a form of youthful Alzheimer's. It's horrible.
Oh.
It's horrible. Yeah. So he's been battling that for about 3 years now.
Yes. Oh, well, this is taking a dark turn. We have
to. Oh, yeah. Yeah. You didn't know that about Pratchett.
No, I had heard that.
Yeah. Have you read Pratchett ever?
I'm not going to answer that question.
Okay.
Because I might not have.
I will say that you have a treat ahead of you.
Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, I am going to adjust your microphone.
Okay.
Your pardon. I just... There. No, there we go.
Okay.
That's right. Oh, Perfect. And remind people that this is WBAI in New York City. This is Hour of the Wolf. I am Jim Freund. With me, Nancy Hightower, who just read us the prologue from Say It Properly, Elementary?
Elementary Rising.
I got it. Elementary Rising.
It. Yes.
And that was nice. That was neat. Now, being that it's already 2:30, we have two choices. You could read your short story, but that would take up almost the rest of the show, because we have outro music, or we can just continue to chat, and if you like, take listener calls.
I can do either. I also have the shorter pieces. I have that short little story.
Oh, okay.
I can do, and two poems that almost act as stories.
Yeah.
If you want me to do that.
Duh.
You want me to do that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Those are short.
I'm used to a longer form show, I should say. Hour of the Wolf used to be 2 hours.
Okay.
We're now 90 minutes. And I used to do 5-hour shows. So.
This is like a 10-minute gig.
Cool.
Okay. So the first one I'm going to read is called The Mummer's Dance. And it's interesting because I was born in Philadelphia. And my father used to take me, actually, to go see the Mummer's Day Parade. And I loved it. And so... my PhD, actually, I got it for a nonfiction dissertation. It was a memoir. And this actually had started to be the first part of the memoir. And then I decided to change it more into a story. So this is called The Mummer's Dance. Broad Street in Philadelphia, New Year's Day, and this is what you see. Men in oversized sequin masks float by, eyes blackened, faces painted white. Tiger stripes line their cheeks. They look over as they pass, smile toothy grins. This is the mummer's parade. The men's red headdresses sway in the wind. Skulls bob up and down on their marching sticks. African natives who have escaped to Philly for the morning. Others follow. Pirates, Chinamen from some forgotten dynasty, clowns. Everything about them is too bright. A pastel dazzle of gaudy costumes, hot pink, lime green, turquoise, vermilion, marches down the street to the cheers of the city. You never see their eyes. My daddy has me on his shoulders, holding my 8-year-old hands tight in his so I don't fall off. He looks up. Are you having fun? Of course, I yell over the band music. Who doesn't love masks? The parade momentarily stops, and one set of mummers dressed in scarlet with papier-mâché dragon heads begins to dance. Their movements are somewhat clumsy, like any group of synchronized dragons would be. The head dancer breaks apart from the rest of the troupe and ambles up to my father and me. Dad plays along, sways in time to the dragon man's rhythm. I must have a heart, the dragon says. The band continues to blare trumpets and drums while the dragon swings its head side to side, teeth and forked tongue bared in a naked, hungry grin. You choose, your heart or your father's. I'm only 8, I explain, banging on my daddy's head in hopes that he'll stop the dragon man from saying such things. But my father continues his strange, slow dance as though he doesn't hear. It is only a costume, I say to myself, except that there's a claw instead of a hand at the end of the scaly arm extending towards us. I lean as far back as I can, but my legs are trapped under my father's hands. Will it hurt? That depends. The dragon's breath smells like my grandfather's, a cross between ash and gin. Give me his heart and you both live. Only your daddy's soul will be gone, but there'll be no one to protect you, Poppet, against those who wish to do you harm. And there are dragons worse than me. I try not to cry at this, knowing the truth he speaks of gin and ash and attic rooms. And if I give you mine. It chuckles as two skeletons shimmy up on the right and begin leapfrogging towards me. You'll not feel a thing, lovely. A pleasant gift, that is. I try to imagine a day without living nightmares or keeping a heart that was already broken, and I'm caught between two worlds. But see now the delicate bones in the skeleton's face flying towards me as the dragon thrusts its claw out. In the instant, I make a choice and point to a heart that will never be mine.
Ooh.
So that was a little bit of a creepy tale.
Yeah.
After Yeah, there's lots of that's kids nice. In my...
That's nice for 2:30 in the morning, I must say, actually.
It's my
I was looking for Lorena McKinnon's version of the Mummers Dance. Great song, but I couldn't...
It is a lovely song.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I tend to, maybe because I teach the grotesque in art and because I teach Kafka stuff, I tend to...
Kafka's about as grotesque as one can get.
I have some newer stuff that's even more grotesque than that. I teach a short story called Rabbits by Kanai Mieko. That is my student's favorite.
Ooh, I don't know that.
I will send that to you.
Yeah, absolutely. These are not the kind that Jeff Vandermeer dances with, right?
I'm just gonna keep checking closer my head with that with no.
Yeah, closer to the Monty Python.
Yes, yeah. The bunnies get it in this story.
Yeah.
It's not pleasant. But it plays, it sort of, it ups the ante on Donnie Darko.
Ooh, okay.
Look at it that way.
Okay. Big rabbits.
Big rabbits, but it's my...
not Harvey.
No. It's my student's favorite...
It's a real puka, not the friendly kind of...
No. It's my student's favorite story. So
really?
There's something sort of magical and wondrous about it. Definitely. Yeah. And then, did you want me to read poems too?
Yeah!
Okay. I'm going to have... I just have two quick ones because they read like stories. And just a quick explanation about these. My stories are based off of, I guess, biblical heroines.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And so I like going through the Old Testament and seeing the stories of the women and trying to think about what would it be like to have been them.
So everybody listening at home, get out a Humintosh for Esther.
That's right. Well, this one I've got Jael and Tamar. So
ooh,
those are the
okay,
two.
Okay, okay.
And Tamar, I love, because for those people that don't know the story, she was the daughter-in-law of Judah, and both of her husbands die. And in the Judaic law, she specifically should have been able to have Judah's last son. But he was so scared of his son dying if he married her that he basically tried to keep her as a lonely widow all her life. So she dresses up as a prostitute. And gets Judah to sleep with her, and that's actually what starts the line of Christ. Basically, it starts the
that's
process.
Approaching New Testament stuff.
Yeah, they were sort of throwing into New Testament stuff.
Yeah, my upbringing, 5 books.
Right, that's right.
That, you know.
But it's interesting because, again, nobody likes to really sort of touch her story, and what...
But now we've got Rasta in the room, so...
That's right.
Hi, Lister. So...
So that's the first story. And then the second story is about Jael, who they're Israel's at war with I forget who. And
they're always at war with somebody.
He's always with somebody. And
themselves.
Sisera is like the guy that they're at war with, and he comes running up to Jael because her husband is his friend. And while he's sleeping, she nails his head to the floor and kills him and wins the battle. and I kind of go, what place do you have to be in where you go, wow, I've got to kill a dude. What do I have on hand?
Very long nail. Very long.
This is what I'm going to do. Like, where do you have to be as a woman to, like, get to that level of brutality? So this would be two poems.
Welcome to New York.
Nah, that's right. Where I keep a tent nail in my purse when I walk down the street.
Okay, good.
So the first one's Tamar. Tell me how many men must I have roll off me in the night and wake to find my husband's dead again. Black widowed into whoredom, I'm a patient woman, waiting lifetimes, sitting on the side of the road, ready to grasp with both hands a lonely soul needing night comfort. There is a journey through the realm of curses, barrenness to push in front of you, a broken cart, God's displeasure, call it what you will. Still I plan to take the lion by the mane and wrestle him till dawn. Will wear his bracelets and pretty trinkets until twins claw their way into history, scarlet bound. Every step is a bruise closer to the serpent's head. So that's number one.
Okay.
And then there's...
And all of you listeners, I hope that you saw how Nancy, like, you know, put that poem down and went, there, take
that. That's right. Is that what I do?
But that one, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you had this piece of like, there, I'm giving that to you. This little moment of finality that was just wonderful.
Yeah. Okay, that's okay. Never knew what my hand gestures are.
And for those who want to see, come to the reading next Tuesday.
Yes, and then you can see me throw down the pieces of paper after I've read from them and the finality of what that I do. So this is JL's piece. And I put the verse in front of it. It's Judges 4:21. And I'll just read you the verse. JL Heber's wife took a nail of the tent and took a hammer in her hand and went softly unto him and smote the nail into his temples and fastened it to the ground. For he was fast asleep and weary, and so he died. So this is the poem. Such a muted sound at first, as spike hits skin, then the skull's soft crunch. One would think murder made more noise, like a battering ram against the temple. But no, just a simple tent nail and a cup of milk. We women have our ways. Had I more time, I would have cooked, made the bed, washed the dishes, scheduled in the killing. But he had come quickly, galloped himself into my sanctuary, heaving breath and muffled gasps, and war-weary, as men often are. I became an eagle, feathers spread, talons reaching as I flew out to meet him, and he, thinking I was his dove, his mother hen, came under my wings, shadow-filled. I wrapped their warmth around him with my voice spinning lies, quilted comfort. His hands tucking into the folds of the blanket as he slipped into that dream-quenching slumber, I almost kissed his brow to drive the pin through. His mother, far away, felt the breeze of my hand as it came down, gentle, loving breath upon her cheek, thought her son had come back early in victory, and opened her arms ready in wide embrace. When she turned, her eyes beheld nothing but red leaves falling in the morning wind.
Ta-da! Yeah, really? Yeah, okay, there you go. This time we actually got the musical flourish.
Well, because I didn't throw down my piece of paper.
There you go. Yeah, I hope all you radio listeners out there saw that.
That's right. Yes. The gesture.
Indeed. Well, let's see. We have about 20 minutes before Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister hits these airwaves. And when I say hit, it's more like explodes upon the air. Would you like to take calls?
Sure. Put on the earphones.
Yeah,
okay.
Put on your headphones.
Such a sexy
telephone
look.
Number here at WBAI.
Oh, wow, that's really loud.
Is there a volume switch?
I don't know, but my voice sounds gigantic.
Okay. I don't know if I can control that from here. Let's see.
That's okay. I just sound really powerful.
Is that any better for you?
No.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Okay, well.
That was better.
Oh, I can...
The other way.
There we go. This way. Okay, testing 1, 2, 3.
That's better.
2, 3. There we go. Okay, so apparently I can control...
The universe.
Your headphone volume. Yeah, well, yes. That's a given.
All the voices in my head.
That's another... Yeah, yeah.
It'd be great if you could...
As I was telling listeners... See, now the calls went away. 212-209-2900. That's right. 212-209-2900 is the number to call to speak to Nancy Hightower. Be on topic.
Do they not be on?
No. It's the callers. Oh. It's the callers. We used to have one who's now sadly departed who, you know, I would be talking about. Speaking of science fiction, the mayor this week, you know, it's like, please, Monroe. Okay, good morning. You're on the radio.
Happy New Year, James.
Happy New Year, Robert.
Miss Hightower, a lovely show.
Oh.
I am looking forward to seeing you next Tuesday night.
Yeah.
Okay, I got a bunch of questions. First of all, you remind me lots of great memories about Boulder. I know Boulder very well. It used to be a radio station. Maybe it's still there. KGNU. Campus radio station.
GNU.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. You've never been a guest on that station, have you?
I have not.
They did a great music show for
this
many years.
This is her first time on the radio.
Oh, wow. They did a great music show for many years called Highway 322 with a gentleman named Mike Bell who used to teach Anglo-Saxon literature and poetry.
Oh, wow.
Now, let me ask you about Mummers Dance. Have you ever seen a traditional Mummers play?
Not a play, no.
Because Boulder happens to have been for many years the site of one of 12 cities which hosted the annual Christmas revels. We used to do the revels in New York until 2010, and many of the revels had Mummer's Place, the traditional type with the St. George and the Dragon combat.
Yeah, some of them are available on YouTube.
Yes, they are. Marvelous. They still do them, by the way, up in Newfoundland as traditional Christmas offerings. Let me ask you a couple of things about your wonderful novel.
Yeah.
Do you have an underlying mythology? What I mean by this is, are we liable to encounter creation myths, origin stories, etc., etc., etc.?
Yes, I do have...
Ooh, I love it already.
Okay. I do have underlying myths in terms of how the relationships of the elements are to each other and who do they answer to, and what was the world like before, because of course, you know, it's one of those things where mankind...
You realize you're making my week.
Okay.
Not long enough, Robert.
Well, you know...
Whatever.
Epic. Epic.
It's epic fantasy. Well, anytime you build a fantasy novel, you know, or a fantasy world, you have to understand sort of everything about it because you're world building. So you have to know everything about how did that world start and what are the rules and... You know, what are the rules of magic, but also the deeper things about myth. What are the myths of the eternal? And
love the way you think. Does your world have music?
Yes, it does. I haven't really delved into each different kind. We have the Irukins, of course, piping, and it depends on, of course, who they serve. Each country serves, is loyal to a particular elementari. So, you know, the elementari of fire, the elementari of water. And so that kind of will...
You know who's going to love this book? The storytellers. There's a lot of cross...
Oh, come on. Who isn't going to love the book?
No, come on. No, they will, but I mean, that's just one group.
Okay, fine. That's one group of dozens and dozens. You know who's going to love this book? Readers.
Yes. Of course, absolutely.
Okay.
Now, you mentioned grotesque.
And listeners.
You mentioned grotesque.
Yes.
This year, sometime in the spring or summer, a book is coming out which you might be interested in. It's being published in conjunction with Penguin Books in Canada and England. It is called The Book of Grotesque Folklore, Myth, and Legend.
Oh, interesting.
It is a comprehensive look at the most grotesque myths, legends, and tales that you can possibly... These are going to make the Brothers Grimm look like a cakewalk.
Well, that's kind of...
Well, the original.
I was about to say, that's kind of easy to do, but hush my mouth.
Yeah, no. These are some of the... And I got to tell you, some of the ones from Greek and Hindu and Japanese are just absolutely wonderful. Now, you mentioned... as I say, your interest in how many of the Old Testament women have you researched?
Oh, I actually have a whole manuscript of these. So I have Eve's, I have Ruth, I have Naomi's, I have Sarah's. Actually, Electra
Esther?
Velocity.
Lilith?
I have Esther.
Yeah.
I don't have Lilith.
Because if you're into food and you're living where you are, you have to do Esther for the Hamantash alone.
Well, I have actually two from Esther. And in Electrovelocipede, the last issue of Electrovelocipede, I have two poems from Sarah's point of view.
Are you going to be reading at that event as well?
Yes, I will. And I'll actually be reading those poems.
Sam Miller will be, and John Klima will be on the show the Wednesday before the Electric Velocipede reading.
Have you done Deborah?
I have not done Deborah yet,
or
but
Judith.
I want to.
Oh. Fascinating. It's interesting of the women of the Old Testament. They were ladies to be proud of.
Oh yes, no.
Good writers.
There are so many women. Actually, there's this one woman called the wise woman. Who there's a story of there's a town in Israel that's besieged and. There's this woman called, she's a wise woman, she calls out, she's like, why are you besieging our town? I think she's talking to Job, and Job's like, we're pursuing this guy who's sought sanctuary in your walls, and she's like, hold on, I'm going to lop his head over the walls in just a minute. And she goes and convinces the town owners, like, this guy, all we need to do is send his head over the wall. And they do, they cut off his head, and they lop it over to Job, and she saves the town. And she doesn't even have a name, she's just called the wise woman.
Oh, I thought you were going to tell me that famous...
And then somebody was going to nail it.
Don't you going to tell me that story where a conquering army tells the women of the town that they may take out one and only one possession of from the town. What they take out are their husbands.
Oh, I did not.
Which is a very well-known global tale, versions of which pop up in North Africa, Turkey, all over the place. Well, it sounds like a fascinating evening next Tuesday.
Well, be there and find out.
Okay.
Okay, take care.
Nice meeting you.
So, we had other calls, but of course, Bob Rodriguez, who that was, used to teach music and folklore and stuff like that for City College.
Oh, wow.
Or CUNY, one of the, so that's where that all comes from. You'll see him on Tuesday, I promise you.
Lovely conversation.
Telephone number here to talk to Nancy Hightower at WBAI is 212-209-2900. Especially now you're photogenic.
Yeah, I know. I'm messing with my hair in these groovy headphones. Yeah, feeling so pretty.
Yeah. No, it's
so,
cool.
So
it's cool.
Pretty.
Okay. I'm going to get out the camera. You
don't,
know
don't,
that.
Don't.
Okay, I will.
It'll be the first death on air.
No.
It's late at night. That's right. And I know the technique.
No. It wouldn't
be
the first
practicing,
death on
the
air.
The spike in the
head.
This
is WBAI. We've been through it all.
All right. That's good.
What started you on this path? What were you reading initially that brought you to teaching the grotesque?
Oh, that was really interesting. Because my PhD, my studies were first in Henry James, right? You can't get more...
Turn of the screw,
the ambassadors, whatever. And then I realized that students probably never wanted to read a story by Henry James, and so I was like, what would interest students? And that's when I was teaching short stories by Flannery O'Connor and Kafka, which I loved.
Yeah.
And they're weird and they're strange, and students are like, what's going on with all these? Like, why did that crazy man shoot that old lady? why does everybody get slaughtered in all these stories, Dr. Hightower? I have nightmares now. Which is things that are said in my class. And what I didn't realize was that there was a whole critical, a very long history of critical theory called the grotesque that went along with these stories that kind of explained what they were trying to do. And basically the whole idea about the grotesque is it wants us to get to look at whoever is marginalized, is the way I teach it. If whoever is marginalized in our society, whether it be race, sexual orientation, economics, whoever we look at as less than us, the grotesque will always find that boundary, and it uses humor and horror to erase it. It wants to push it. It is wanting to trample it. It wants to get whoever you have damned in the name of intellect, in the name of politics, whoever that person is that you are like, not, they're not different than me. They are less than me because of their difference. The grotesque will go after that. And it's my job to have the stories and the film that will trigger, you know, that boundary in whoever is looking at it. It's hard. It's hard to have a class on it. It's a lot coming at you because it unleashes a lot in your psyche that you might not want to deal with. I feel like I should have probably gotten a PhD in psychology while teaching this.
Sounds like you're halfway there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought of writing a nonfiction book on this?
Yes, actually, we have a call out for a nonfiction collection of essays for new essays about the grotesque. Because I definitely think it needs to be pursued more. Again, not as the bizarre just to be bizarre, but the importance of what these writers were trying to look at. Again, to talk about the things that are not approachable in our society.
Mm-hmm.
The things that we often don't see. How does the grotesque suddenly give us eyes to render the invisible visible?
Wow.
I am
so there. To me, that is just so fabulous. You know, that's the beginning of it, but the idea. I used to think that I didn't like horror. You know, I like fantasy, I like science fiction. And then I was discovering that now, you know, I guess my problem with horror has to do more with like slasher movies of the 80s.
Right.
I am not a fan of gore.
No.
I am proud and queasy. You know, if I get queasy watching a film, then it's not entertainment. If I'm going to have nightmares about that film.
Right.
But when I read it, A, gets under my skin in a deeper way. Further into the brain, more it's assimilated better, and B, it's generally not the visceral gore.
Yes,
when good horror is written, and so if one reads the books edited by Ellen Datlow, the best horror of the year, and things like that, I start to realize, oh wait, maybe I do like this stuff after all. And by those definitions, the Brothers Grimm are absolutely horror. I mean, how many chos can you chop off before you say,
right,
how many princes can you blind with thorns?
Yeah. The bummer thing about, so this is one rule about the grotesque that some theorists have set up, and they said fairy tales don't count. Because with fairy tales, let me explain why.
Okay,
I
heard
you growl. You growled.
I'm sorry.
And air towards
me. I'm a big
me.
Fairy tale fan, I know. You see.
The only reason why is because when you have a fairy tale, you go into the land of once upon a time. There's something about the reader that relaxes then, going, well, anything can happen. And again, this is not my rule. This is the rule of other theorists. But what happens is, if you assume, though, that something is true, you see, then the horror can suddenly really take you if you're unclear of where does the boundary between the real and the unreal happen.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're and if the reader's always like, I don't understand, is this real or not real? And if you keep it guessing and it's never answered. Whereas again, with the fairy tale, with the ghost story, it's not allowed because again, you relax, go, well, anything could happen. I'm not saying that those can't still grab you. They can. But psychologically, it operates on a different playing level.
Mm. I would argue that to an extent. I'd also point out, by the way, that the Brothers Grimm don't write fairy tales. They write household tales.
They write household tales, but still it is the land of once upon a time. And again,
yeah,
in including modern theory,
it
the
does.
Grotesque.
Any number of their stories start with those words.
They do. And there is an enjoyment. There's an uncomfortability, but there's an enjoyment that we have to the Brothers Grimm that you will not have when you read Rabbits.
True.
Trust me.
I do. I haven't read that yet. But, you know, one of my favorite Brothers Grimm stories, very short, Cat and Mouse in Partnership. You know, this is the one in which the cat and the mouse live together and they have a barrel of lard that they're going to share. And they're going to keep it for, you know, the cold season. And Cat goes out one night and the mouse says, where were you? Oh, I was at a christening. What was the baby's name? Just scratched the surface. And then the second baby was halfway through. The third one is almost done. And the fourth one, the mouse realizes that the cat's been going out and eating all the lard against their partnership. And the mouse accuses him. The mouse is female and the cat is male. How dare you? Here we are in partnership and all that. And the end of the story is, the cat eats the mouse. And the moral of the story is, and that's the way of the world.
Cute, not grotesque, but cute.
Not grotesque,
no.
But the point is, this is not layback, feel-good fairy tales.
That's true. And often with the grotesque, there is no moral, which is what lots of people find the most disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
I would say there is always a moral in the Grimm. There's always a...
That's more... Yeah, and the ones that I have a problem with are Hans Christian Andersen.
Those I'm not very schooled in. But, you know, with fairy tales, I get to go
teach. The latest one is Frozen on the screens. It's the Snow Queen.
I have not seen
which that. Which is Little Mermaid, I mean, all these Disneyfied things, The Ugly Duckling, these are all Hans Christian Andersen, and they are all extremely moralistic, Christian, very Christian, it's his middle name. Tales of morality, and those have really horrid events. You know, the Little Mermaid loves the man who lives on the land, so she dies. This is not what they do in Disney.
Yes,
Disney,
no,
they
no.
change it.
I see this deep-seated anger.
But that is what Hans Christian Andersen is about.
Well, okay.
Also, Hans Brinker and his skates. You know, all those are all. But it's not the stories, the fairy tales of Charles Perrault told in the salons of France.
Yes.
Where they really start. They're not the fairy tales of Rick Bowes.
No.
And his new book of fairy tales.
I know about Charles Perrault because I guest lecture in Dora Goss's classroom.
And I was about to cite her.
Very good. Yes, no. I'm actually going to go lecture about, because I do the art side to her literature.
Ah,
yes.
How wonderful.
It's lovely. I love guest lecturing in her class. It's fabulous. So I show all the grotesque art about Little Red Riding Hood.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. And Bluebeard.
Tell Dora she hasn't done this show now in a few years. It's time.
I will remind her.
Time is here.
I'm going to see her in Boscone when I give John Boccacci a big hug. And, you know, I will.
Boscone? Is that upcoming?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
It's
Boston. I won't get to Boscone. I'll be there, near there for ReaderCon.
I love how I'm just telling everybody where I'm going to be, like countless strangers across
okay,
America.
Well, you know what? We are,
I'm feeling so safe now.
Would you believe me if I told you our show ended a minute and a half ago?
I can totally believe it.
Yeah.
I'm out of saliva. I'm ready to go.
And we're out of time, but I'm going to tell the listeners where you're going to be.
Oh,
on Tuesday, along with D.T. Friedman at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings at 138 Sullivan Street. Doors open at 6:30. Admission is free. Come meet Nancy Hightower, who you've been listening to, and the wonderful Dr. Danielle Friedman, who was here about 2 months ago. It will be a night to remember.
Bye.
Thank you for being here, and thank you, listeners, for listening. And be sure to tune in next week when I start talking about folk music. Something I haven't done in a while, but it is time. Have a wonderful morning. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister. Oh, yes, and visit us on Facebook. Take care. Oh, yeah, this is Steel Ice Band.
Like many others take the same same turn like me, they yearn for the flag to. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a cymbal. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
1985 Callista Live right here. 7 minutes after 3 o'clock, burn the imperialist flag to ashes before 5 o'clock right here, traditionally on a Thursday. 3 o'clock until 5 o'clock right here at 1985 Callista Live, WBAI. Now you know why we had to call the show. Burn, baby. Thank you.